Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. This podcast is something rather special. Kelly Gardner, Imagining the Past's former host, returns to interview Fiona Kelly McGregor. Kelly Gardner writes historical fiction for all ages. Her books include 1917, shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Young People's History Prize, Act of Faith and The Sultan's Eyes, both shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, and the Swashbuckler Pirate Trilogy, Goddess, a novel based on the life of queer, sword-fighting, cross-dressing opera star Mademoiselle de Maupin, is being adapted for the screen. Her latest series is The Fireworker Chronicles. Fiona Kelly McGregor has published 8 books. The fiction books include the short story collection Suck My Toes, Dirt, which won the Steel Rudd Award, and the underground classic Chemical Palace. Her novel, Indelible Ink, won the Age Book of the Year and was published in French. Her novel, Iris, was shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023 and is her first foray into historical fiction. It's a great pleasure to welcome them both today to Imagining the Past.
Thanks, Greg. Welcome, Fiona, and thank you for coming along.
Thanks for having me. It's fabulous to be here.
We're going to focus today on your book, Iris, and so could we start with Iris Webber herself? Could you tell us a little bit about her and her life?
Yeah, she was born in the Salvation Army Women's Home in Bathurst in 1906, and she was taken up to Glen Innes by her mother. She was the second child of what would end up being a family of 6, and she grew up with a stepfather and step-siblings and blood-siblings in Glen Innes, and then she went down to Hay in 1932 at the age of 25. She was arguing with her husband, and there was an incident then. And she spent some months on remand in Hay Jail and then made her way over to Sydney in about 1933 or 34, when the Depression was still going. The city was coming out of the Depression, but there was a lot of poverty in the inner city. And she appeared on the census in Glebe. And then she started to get into trouble with the police, and she dropped off the census. And she died in 1953 in Surry Hills.
So how did you find out about her?
So I first saw her in an exhibition at New South Wales Parliament House in, 2002, I think it was for the Gay Gains, and it was an exhibition about gay and lesbian history, what we then called gay and lesbian history, without the full acronym that we use now. And it was the photograph that is on the cover of the book, just the really arresting mugshot, which was taken actually 10 years after the events of the book take place, because I chose the years 1932 to 1937 to dramatise my story. And she's, at the time of the photograph, she was on remand at Long Bay Reformatory for Women. And I just became quite fascinated with her. The Plaque was very sort of tabloid and sensationalist, and as I was to later find out, quite ahistorical, but quite sort of affectionate. I mean, she was sort of glamorized as a lesbian gangster. And I had just published my fourth book, Chemical Palace, and I usually go off into a sort of, if I don't have a specific project after a book, I usually go and do random research. And that's what I, that's when I started to research it. And I found a really different story, a much more grim, unglamorous story. And so that was 20 years ago. And I guess I spent those years trying to figure out how to write that story, because I wasn't a historical novelist. I guess I sort of am now, but it's not my main thing, which it is yours. You're a total specialist. And so I felt intimidated by not knowing that form. And I did a PhD, and I, you know, I did a lot of other projects in that time, other books and art projects. And I gradually came around to realizing that, in fact, the historical novel form was the best way to tell her story.
I mean, your PhD was actually about Iris, wasn't it? It was, but that nonfiction, or was your novel part of your PhD?
Both, but I withdrew the fictional element because from being publicly available online, because I wasn't happy with it. And in fact, very little of that material survived into the published novel. But the exegesis is online and easily accessible, and anyone who's interested in the material can find that. And so it was both part of my PhD, and for me, researching the whole social context was just as important as researching her. I couldn't portray her or understand her without understanding the times that she lived in.
So was that the topic of the PhD? Was what did you want to find out at the start of that project, and what did you find out? Were they different things?
Yeah, well, I actually went into that with a really broad question, and I think it's part of the reason it took me so long. And I just called The Life and Times of Iris Webber, the marginal crim of Slygrog, Sydney. And it was important. I mean, she did go on to be a Slygrogger in Woolloomooloo in the period after my book takes place. It's what she did in the 1940s, and very different place and job description. But it was important also, I realised, that she was such a marginal figure, even in the criminal world, and that she was a petty criminal as opposed to a sort of Machiavellian gangster type figure. People who know the period will know that Tilly Devine and Kate Lee were, and they're quite remarkable, the success that they had as women.
Yeah.
But Iris wasn't like that. She was really hand-to-mouth, day by day. Petty crimes to get by.
Yeah. Well, as I imagine, you know, most people were, there were not too many Tilly Devines. And so I'm guessing that people like Tilly and Kate Lee were, their lives are rather more well documented than somebody like Iris. So, and in fact, a lot of people were trying to keep out of the record.
Yeah.
So the good thing is, when they committed a crime, you get to find some record of it. But did you have access to much archival material about Iris and the people immediately around her? How did you build this story?
Well, interestingly, because I'm going back into the archives a little bit at the moment for the early 1940s, and what's happened in this period, which is almost 25 years, is that the police archives have become much more strict. So embargoes have increased. And so I did access more than I would be able to now. And I went all to the primary sources, all of the police records, the gazettes, the jail entrance cards, the court depositions. It's quite patchy, partly because as a petty criminal, most of her court records are in Central Criminal Court. Not a lot of them survive. It's also patchy because there was a flood in the 1980s that destroyed a lot of material in the warehouse in Bankstown. And So I can't. And the other reason is actually because this is a pre-digital, I sort of was straddling the pre-Trove era. And so it's interesting when I go back onto Trove now, there's so much more than was there originally. I mean, I did find a lot of stuff on microfilm. And in fact, my first field trip to Hay, I found things in the Hay Library that were not digitized at all. And they are now. So I often think more is going to surface. And I would love to see somebody come along and do some kind of coda with, you know, extra material if it appears.
One of the things I suppose too about the archives or the primary sources in particular is that queer lives especially are often, there are silences in the archives and the records about queer lives and gaps. What do you do with silences and gaps in the record?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think that this is one of the reasons that I decided upon the novel, because the novel is the form that allows you to imagine the inner worlds of people, and the outer worlds are fundamentally important because that is how we are formed from this whole combination of things. So I was very meticulous about my world building, and once I had that, I was able to imagine Iris as a person, but I don't think I would have been able to imagine her as fully if I hadn't done that other research. And the silences and the gaps are, there have been really great LGBTIQ historians and academics in Australia that I'm indebted to, and there's a full list of them in the back of the book. But there are two in particular that I should mention, Ruth Ford and Lucy Chesser. And they did a lot of research into the early 20th century material, and they're actually really good writers. And not all academic history is that easy to read, but I find their work eminently readable. And so I really learned a lot from them, but not just actual stories. I learned how to interpret those silences. And I think that also because I'm, you know, I came of age during the AIDS crisis, you know, at a time when it was still very difficult. So it was not too hard for me to project myself back there. And the other thing about those silences and is that they are not entirely historical, because so much, I mean, the discrimination that we receive is really on moral grounds. And so there's an element of shame. And I think that that persists. And certainly it's in the lifetime of queers at my age. And I think that just using all of that, like, therefore, what I mean is that I did rely upon my personal experience and my personal history and the history of my community as well to interpret those silences.
And I wondered too, with those, the voices that you created, particularly Iris's voice, but also the dialogue with people and then the conversations that people have and the language they use, whether some of that came from the primary source. Well, could you hear Iris's voice in police statements or court transcripts or anything, or did you have to kind of invent that as well?
Well, yeah, she does. She has a voice, because as time went on, really sort of after, I mean, the framework of the novel 1932 to 37 was chosen because going back to that idea of my opening question, we all write a novel with an opening question in a way, was what is a criminal, and therefore how does one become a criminal at a time when homosexuality is illegal, although it's only, that law was only directed to men on the books. Lucy Chesser and Ruth Ford elucidate how it was applied to women, for instance. Indigenous people didn't have citizenship. People were incredibly poor, and a lot of women turned to commercial sexual transactions, which we wouldn't call sex work by today's standards, but which essentially were. So therefore, you know, it was very easy to be a criminal. And Iris, I think, so Iris became a notorious criminal really largely because of her sexual orientation. And so she's quoted a lot in later newspaper reports. And there's also a whole set of letters that she wrote from Long Bay Jail, actually around the time of that photograph. And her voice is actually very formal in those contexts. And you can tell she's kind of bunging it on. She's
trying really hard.
Absolutely. She's speaking in legalese. And one of the things that she was known for was that she was really smart. She sacked her lawyers. She defended herself. And she saved newspaper clippings pertaining to criminal cases that resembled hers, a little bit like a lawyer prepares their briefs with, a set of law books, but she didn't have them. And so she sort of taught herself law. And so the voice that is on the public record is actually quite punsy and formal, but you can tell it's undone.
Yeah.
And because there's a little bit of occasionally that rough street vernacular kind of pokes through. Right. And I just sort of built it with, I read all of the fiction of the period, which focuses on working class lives in the inner city, Christina Stead, Kylie Tennant, Ruth Park, Louis Stone. The voice in the letters from jail is like a lawyer's voice. It's incredible. Written in this beautiful copper plate, these sentences that are about 8 lines long, and if you would be so kind, esteemed, so and so, like, I'd love to be able to use some of the letters, actually. I don't know how yet, but we'll see.
You do have her kind of bunging it on with the lawyers when they come to see her in prison, don't you, and just annoying them with her pseudo legal knowledge.
Yeah, and she's actually correct. That's the thing, is it? Yeah. She. What I sort of realized is that she probably learnt by heart the Vagrancy Act, and the Vagrancy Act was amended in the late 20s, and it's a big reason why jails were overcrowded, and it was essentially used to punish the poor in working class neighbourhoods. The consorting laws are a part of that, the tiny little law around gathering arms that she was most commonly arrested on was a part of the Vagrancy Act. So I think that she probably, went to the state library and pulled it out and wrote it down and memorized it.
Yeah.
So she could defend herself.
Amazing.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about this book was the sense of place. For readers who know Sydney, know Darlinghurst and Surry Hills, it's so vivid and alive. How did you go about recreating those streets and smells and that sort of long-lost sense of that inner city?
Well, I live in Redfern, 10 minutes walk from Clisdell Street, where the book is mostly set. And so I really did a lot of walking around the places, and I walked to the addresses in Darlinghurst and Glebe. Walking is important because you're down on the street level, like you can't really get the sense from driving. And I grew up in Sydney, and so I have memories of those places. I came into the inner city when I was 17, and I have memories of those places in the early 1980s, before the big changes of motorways and apartment blocks. I mean, Sydney's population has grown by about 2 million or maybe doubled just in my lifetime. And again, lots of reading. Ruth Park is really great for place, actually. She's got a really sensual response to place. And actually, Fishing in the Sticks describes the streets 5 minutes walk from where Iris lived. And Ruth Park is also good because she actually went and researched the history of Sydney, including the geology and the types of plants. I mean, there's only about one tree in the whole of Iris. There's not much vegetation, but I mean, there's a climate, even in this factory city, there's still a climate, and it's a Sydney climate. So I think that helps. And it's always been an important factor in my writing too.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, I suppose, about place, and this is, again, Ruth Park and Kylie Tennant and those mid-20th century novelists are writing about community in place. And that is something that comes through so beautifully in Iris, that everyone knows one another. It reminds me actually of my mum's stories of Port Melbourne when she was a kid, and I even remember this. Everybody knows everybody. Everyone's struggling, some a bit more legal than others, but everybody's looking out for one another, and there's also humour and sing-alongs and alliances, shifting. And a bit of a sense of us and them, I suppose, with the cops and the rest of the world. What did you draw on to capture that kind of community spirit?
Yeah, I think exactly what you're describing, almost like a village kind of
thing.
And predicated largely by, I mean, this is an ambulant environment. People didn't own cars. And a tram to Mona Vale, that was like getting a plane to Byron Bay. People would go there for holidays, you know. And so one's world is smaller. And the combination, and also in those, well, in the neighbourhoods where Iris was living, again, going back to that thing of what is a criminal? Well, most people were, in a sense, because also the law was so punitive around the sale and consumption of alcohol, gambling, sex work, all of those things that were common in those neighbourhoods. So people would have been looking out for each other, but they also would have been prying into other people's business and judging them. And she's in a very difficult situation because she's queer, but she's also, and she was, according to the public record, it is significant that she didn't try to hide it, because I couldn't find really any other woman except women of upper class or bohemian backgrounds that could afford to shuck convention. And she just kind of forged through like that. So she would have been in a precarious position because of that. And there are actually newspaper articles that talk about her relations with her neighbours.
Yeah.
And gave me a little bit of insight into that.
Well, let's talk about that love story a little bit. Or how did you approach writing a queer love story set in a time where the only language, the only words they had for it were sort of insults? And yeah, they are in this sort of enclosed community with all this pressure.
Yeah. Well, I had to put there's a little note about the language at the front of the book to say that, because the way that people spoke to each other and about each other, anybody who was not, you know, the proverbial straight white male, there were epithets for everybody all the way up to Irish Catholics, you know. And, you know, that would have been according to your ethnicity, your gender, the size of your body, everything. It was just common. What we would call today insults would have been part of everyday language. And I needed to keep that in order to keep the book in its time. But I also couldn't, I am absolutely 500% sure that if we really went back to that time, their language would have been much, much harsher, much harsher. So I had to sort of find a middle ground between not kind of insulting the 21st century reader, but also not mollifying them and sanitizing the material. And that, you know, that it also included how does one form a relationship, a sort of a homosexual or a queer relationship in a time when it was so hidden. It was so frightening. It was so shameful. It was illegal. It was just sort of at the time when it was moving into the idea of it being not so much a crime as a mental illness. So, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire. And I guess I just had to imagine that. And again, reading as much as I could, and reading actually things from other parts of the world and using my imagination and knowing full well that it's a story that I invented. I can't tell you exactly what happened, really. Yeah.
I just want to come back a bit to that idea of criminality, and it's not crime fiction as such in it, that it's not detective fiction, but there are many, many crimes in it, or there are things that are seen as crimes in it as well. But one of the things I've noticed in recent fiction, in particular books by women about women who are accused of crimes, is that it's less about did she or didn't she, is she guilty or not guilty, and more about her life and not portraying her as a helpless victim. I'm thinking about Burial Rights and Alias Grace and Half Wild, and even in nonfiction like Janet Leigh's The Killing of Louisa. Was that a conscious thing for you to portray somebody who is seen as a criminal? But I mean, you've got that plot thread, I suppose. It's just one strand of her life is the tension about whether or not she is going to be, whether or not she's guilty and whether or not she's going to be found guilty. But it's not the most important thing. It's not the structure of the novel. Was that a conscious thing for you? And how did you think about that whole framework of women and criminality?
I think Annie's Grace was one of my totem books, actually. I really admire the way she went into that. And another one was, well, actually, the other ones weren't necessarily related to women. And I know exactly what you mean, and I think it's because people are essentially turning the lens back onto the society. To ask the question more pertinently of why did these women behave the way they did because of the circumstances? Let's look at the circumstances they were in that elicited that kind of behavior. Yeah. So it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was a conscious thing. I would say it's more like an inevitable thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there's also, I suppose, that sense, again, it's not crime fiction in a sense, except for crimes happening, that that distinction between justice and the law or the faith in justice and the law. And I wondered what you were thinking about or decisions that you had to make about portraying crime and portraying the cops and the courts and the prison system and how all those things interacted for Iris. Did you have a clear view about how she saw them or did you have to imagine a whole lot of those interactions?
Well, she was always pretty obstreperous and pretty righteous in court when she was quoted in the depositions as well as in the newspaper. And I guess the social justice element was pretty clear. It was inevitable again. And I think it becomes organic as well when you're writing a novel and you're putting together all of those elements, the primary sources, then the knowledge of what society was like, and the 21st century imagination, which has all the hindsight and has shut off a lot of the opprobrium that would usually apply, is able to give, I think, a more sophisticated view of all that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that some of the sources were ahistorical.
Oh, did I? I was using that. Oh.
Well, and I think you mentioned a little bit in the afterword that you ploughed through all these materials, say the truth, or that later newspaper reports about her, but even police reports and so on, and that you could often see primary sources as truthful, but of course they're always the product of the people who wrote them, the people that produced them, the police that took the statements, the journalists who are writing about them. What did you do with that sort of having to turn around, having to dig in, I suppose? So the primary sources, if they're not telling any sort of objective truth, how do you draw truth out of them?
Oh, I think that what happens, truth becomes, it's like that Freudian thing of there is truth in the lies. What's that adage by Freud? So that it doesn't actually matter what the police are saying when they note down a crime, because what you're reading, it, the truth that you're getting out of that is a truth about the character of that policeman and a truth about the institution and a truth about the legislation and the society, as well as about the person. And that's the layered sort of truth that I was reading for. One thing that actually has bothered me about portrayals of Iris is that since, the work of Peter Doyle, he's a fantastic interpreter of this material, and he sort of pioneered the interpretation of crime scene photography from just before Iris's time, actually, the 1920s. And he interprets it with that full sense of layered truths, and he's always looking at criminals as people first and foremost. And I think I learnt a lot from that. Like, we are very old colleagues, you know, we've passed from a sort of mentorship to a friendship, really. And it's the other way that I was able to do that is, for instance, I could cross-reference material. Like, there's a Tumblr journalist called Vince Kelly that wrote a lot of true crime books that looked at celebrity policemen, and all, including Lillian Armfield and a couple of other policemen. One of them was an undercover cop. And so he writes about crimes in his books, and they're published in from the late 50s to the early 70s, and there was no citational discipline around true crime at that time. So a lot of what he writes is really biased and really conflated with his own sort of morals. And I was able to cross-reference the actual crimes as written in the newspapers by the police and the police gazettes in his version. And I could see, I could actually pick apart what was conjecture and what really happened. So cross-referencing, as well as that layered imaginative interpretation of resources. But you have to be informed. You can't just dream upon it. You know, it has to really be anchored by everything actual that exists.
So how do you balance that tension between historical veracity and imagination?
Well, I think the historical veracity was my parameter that I could never, it was my disciplined parameter that I could not fuck with. And I'm writing something set in the 1940s now, and I'm maintaining that. And one of the reasons I sort of feel more passionate about it now than even in the years when I was finishing Iris, because we are seeing more LGBTIQ stories come into popular readership and on our TV screens and cinema screens. And going back through history as well, so many of them are fudging the history. It's beginning to really disturb me. And I think that probably the reason they are is that the preferred emotional tone of a narrative is something that's sentimental and quite sanitized. And queer history is not those two things at all. It's a history of a lot of violence and a lot of shame and a lot of persecution. And if you sit with those three things, violence, shame, and persecution, you're going to have a brutal story. And I think by getting rid of those things, those narratives are rendered false. And I don't want my book to fall by the wayside because gradually it's going to be revealed that it was inaccurate. I mean, by the same token, I'm trying to think, I haven't been bailed up by historians, and I think they could be quite keen to do so. So I was sort of waiting a little bit worried for a while, but it still hasn't happened. So I'm hoping that I got that right. And I do get a lot of, like, I got Peter to read the manuscript, and he's a bit of an expert. You know, he's in his 70s now, so a lot of that's in living memory of his parents' generation. And yeah, I guess it's really important to me. It's probably more important than ever, actually. Yeah.
I suppose the other thing too is, and I've been through this with my own writing, is that you in a sense you fall in love with these people. You know, you spend all this time, in your case 25 years, thinking about this person. I don't know whether it's love or whatever it is, but you have to be committed to them.
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of subconscious desire to present them in a, so that other people feel like that about them as well. And so it is easy to accidentally try and make people into queer icons or feminist icons, just the way other people in the past have made them into monsters.
Yeah.
We all, you know, we bring these characters to light and we want them to be seen in a certain light, whatever that light may be. Holding back and knowing that's a possibility and holding back is one of the tensions, I think, when you're writing about real people.
Yeah. Look, I would love her to be a folk hero, a queer icon. I'd love her to replace Ned Kelly. don't get me wrong, I would. I'd love to see that. put her up on a statue, you know, pull down Captain Cook. but I just, I don't know if it's possible because she is pretty gritty. I don't know. I guess time will tell, really.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you don't, and that's one of the things about creating characters, adding layers to people who existed in reality, is that you also show her at her worst.
Yeah.
And her most pathetic and her, you know, her flaws, I suppose, for want of a better term. So icons don't usually have.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. She's abject. She's violent. She's devious. She's treacherous. But I think that a folk hero could. I mean, it's interesting just going back to the Ned Kelly example because there he was with all of his flaws. He's still a hero. But we come into a gender situation there, don't we? And how much more men are allowed to get away with than women. So it probably depends on that to some extent. But yeah, I don't know. Like I couldn't have not given her those rough edges. It just would have been false, really.
Yeah. 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 Actually, just on that gendered lives that everybody lives in this book, how did you write yourself into the headspace? So for one of the examples is that a couple of the women have this conversation where you've got to have a man because who will protect you if you don't have a man? And in fact, for Iris, of course, the man who was supposed to be protecting her was beating the shit out of her. So that headspace, that worldview is quite uncomfortable, I imagine. How did you write yourself into it so that those characters could have those discussions and come alive like that in that gendered space?
Well, you know, I think life is still pretty gendered. I think that if we look at who rules us in this country or even around the world, it's 99% men. Really, I mean, we're looking at the rise of fascism, actually. It's the most despicable men, really. So I also, you know, I grew up in the 1970s in a very gendered household. And you just sort of pull back into, like, I'm not going to be sitting here thinking that things for her were the same as they are for me now, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just also wanted to ask you a little bit about craft and process because it's quite a complex, you've got a lot of research and you've got a huge number of characters. Do you do you just see what happens? Do you plan things like structure? How do you go about a big project like this? And you're used to working in lots of different forms and in lots of different art forms, in fact. So I wonder how you start a project like this and where does it start and how do you go about it?
Well, yeah, I haven't always plotted my books, but I knew that I needed a strong structure for this book. And first of all, the decision about that 5-year framework was very rock solid. The voice changed on the fourth draft from third person to first person.
Uh-huh.
Took me that long to get Iris's voice. And when her voice came through, there was a liberation of sorts. But I realized as I was doing that draft that I couldn't just have her voice. You know, the third person voice comes in as a sort of, in a way, going back to the idea that the historically, not the historically veracious, sorry, but I introduced the third person sections because they're like tent pegs and all of those sections take place in the places of punishment and authority, the courtrooms, the jail, the police stations. And it's an opportunity for us to see Iris as other people saw her, the people who really wanted to punish her.
Yeah.
And I think it was really necessary for us to see that because otherwise we'd just get swept away by her voice, which is seductive. But that gave me an idea of the different voices determine the structure. So Alias Grace did that really well. It was another reason I really liked that book. And I was attracted to the other books that I was attracted to were The Book of Night Women by Marlon James, which doesn't do much with structure and plot, I have to say. It's more of a teeming plot, but it's just in one trajectory. But Billy Bathgate by E.L. Doctorow has a really interesting structure that goes back and forward in time, and I learned a lot from that about how to work my backflashes in, because I flashbacks, sorry, how to work the flashbacks in, because I knew I wanted to have a look at what happened in Hay before she comes to Sydney, and I knew I wanted to look at her childhood again for the question of what, how is a person formed. So that book helped me understand how to do flashbacks. And Hilary Mantel's first two books were really wonderful to, again, figure out how to use time in a imaginative way. Matilda Imlar was my first editor at Picador, and she gave me really fantastic structural feedback. And those are probably the main lessons I learned. And I cut this manuscript up in between drafts and physically moved things around. I really had a sort of physical material relationship with this book, much more than with previous books. And I know
you printed it out and like bits of paper. Yep.
Yeah. And in that way, and I had, you know, a lot written, like I had, you know, the four different parts, and I didn't need those four parts to be symmetrical. But by laying the different chapters across the floor, I could see, it's like a synesthesia thing, you know, you can see physically the rhythm which transports the sound, because it's, you know, and I read out loud, and that that probably helps me with plotting more, gets rid of extraneous stuff.
So you couldn't hear Iris's voice until the fourth draft. And so what happened? You heard it suddenly?
Yeah, I think.
Or you fell into it?
I think that somebody, when I was doing the PhD, somebody said this doesn't sound right. It sounds, there's a sort of, you know, the modern middle class third person thing. And I went, oh yeah, it's true. And I gave it a go, and it just went boom and rushed out of me. And I think probably by that time I was like 10 years into it, and I was reading a lot of early 20th century fiction. And I had a period of 2 or 3 years where I really fell out of touch with what my Auslit colleagues were doing. I didn't read contemporary fiction, and I just immersed myself. I only read what was written then, or what was written about that time. And then I came out of, the voice came out of, flew out of me. But yeah, it sounds like magic, but it's not. It's just, I think it was like, in a way, it's like learning a language. And being able to finally speak it.
Yeah. Oh, and you'd spent all those years studying it, That's
exactly right.
And knowing her so well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about Iris and the process that you've been through in creating this. It's really a magnificent book. I loved it, and I recommend, if people haven't read it, that they rush out and buy it immediately. So congratulations, and thank you again.
Thank you so much. It's been a great honour and a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.